Are you struggling with addiction or alcohol problems? If you're depressed, drinking, and using drugs, you may need help. And the Affordable Care Act guarantees coverage of substance abuse.
I knew I could get myself out of this. I just needed some hope and some help.
I took the first step to recovery when I made the call.
Call the Addiction Hope and Helpline now for a free assessment with someone who cares. Call 800-547-6533. 800-547-6533.
I feel like I'm losing control. I'm afraid I'll lose my job or even my family.
Call now for hope and help with proven, gentle recovery programs.
I never thought that I could be somebody who didn't drink and use drugs.
I'm in recovery, getting the help I need.
Call the Addiction Hope and Helpline now for a free assessment with someone who cares. Call 800-547-6533. 800-547-6533. 800-547-6533.
From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network, and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. After 15 years and two failed wars, borrowing from Teddy Roosevelt, speak softly and carry a big stick. Is it time to walk softly, relying more on soft power, or do we need to continue to have a strong capacity to bring a stick? The limits of soft power and the necessity of military force, that's the case our guest makes today. Today on Business Talk with Jim Campbell, Dr. Elliot Cohn is the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced and International Studies, former counselor at the State Department under Condi Rice. He's the prize-winning author of several books, including Supreme Command and Conquered into Liberty. Dr. Cohen's new book, The Big Stick, The Limits of Soft Power and the Necessity of Military Force. Welcome, Elliot.
Great to be with you.
I initially thought it was kind of ironic that you worked at the home of soft power and you're a hard power guy. Amidst all this kind of war fatigue, why now?
Well, the book, basically because I think we're in the middle of a great debate about the American role in the world. And in some ways, it should have been triggered by the end of the Cold War. Because during the Cold War, there was a consensus on this kind of global presence that we had and a commitment to maintaining global order. We didn't have that debate after the Cold War because in the 1990s, being predominant was cheap. Other people paid for the first Gulf War. And then in the 2000s, we had the emergency of 9/11 and everything that followed from that. So in a way, this is a book about a belated debate, but I do think it's upon us, and it's in many ways coming at us because of the presidency of Donald Trump in a much more forceful and direct way than I expected when I began writing the book.
In fact, let me ask you, there's talk of abandoning NATO, post-war alliances, maybe cozying up to Russia, opting out of trade pacts, maybe a trade war. Do you see either Trump himself reigning in an era of neo-isolationism, or the people, this is kind of what we want?
I think he very well could. He uses the phrase America first, and I think he, and for sure his advisors, know what kind of historical resonance that has. I mean, that was the slogan of Charles Lindbergh and the isolationists, who were also, in many ways, Nazi sympathizers during in 1940. Mm-hmm. So I think he knows what he's doing. Now, he wouldn't have been successful if he wasn't touching something that was actually out there. So, you're dealing both with the individual, but also I think you are dealing with the sentiments of a lot of Americans just now.
Do you see us still as the indispensable nation? And if so, what are the risk of pullbacks along the lines of what we were just talking about?
Well, absolutely, we're indispensable. There's no other country in the world that has our combination of wealth, of military power, intellectual energy, financial markets, you name it, plus the kind of cultural qualities that you need to be able to build huge coalitions. You know, something like NATO, the Chinese couldn't pull that off. The Russians couldn't pull that off. So it's either us or nobody. And I think one of the things that has happened to us is, you know, the World War II generation is pretty much gone. People have forgotten what a really chaotic world looks like. They don't know what the 1920s and 1930s were like. But I think we could easily be headed into that kind of world, a world of self-help, of trade wars, and then really big and really destructive wars, which would bring us back into the international system, but at an extremely heavy price.
Wow. I want you to summarize now some of your thoughts on the use of hard power. And starting off with Caspar Weinberger had his principles that were very well, almost famous, and set in stone. How do you relate to his, and what are you recommending?
Sure. So the Caspar Weinberger, Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Defense, in 1984 laid out six principles for the use of force. And they included things like the United States should only send combat forces to fight for vital interests, and the use of force should always be a last resort, and so on. And in a way, that's come back a bit after, particularly after the last 15 years. What I argue in the book, this is really in the last chapter, is the problem is that when you look closely at those principles, they don't actually mean anything. You know, you only fight for vital interests. Well, what defines a vital interest? It turns out it's a very slippery concept. Or you should only fight as a last resort. Well, you know, you always have the option of surrendering. You know, we did not have to go to war against Nazi Germany, for that matter, if we didn't really care to. So the test is a lot kind of squishier and not useful than it first appears. And what I do in the in that last chapter is try to set up in opposition what I think are some of the main takeaways from, particularly from our recent experience, but also since I am an historian, the past going back quite some way. And they're not as cheerful, and they're not as it's not as much of a checklist that people can apply. But I think it's a lot more, they're a lot more realistic than the Weinberger principles.
Give us an overview of them.
So the first one, probably the most important one, is understand your war for what it is, not for what you wish it to be. I think one of the things, and this really strikes me as a military historian, is people find it very hard to really understand any given war in its uniqueness, and to really get to the heart of what's going on. So, for example, early on in the Iraq War, when I was outside government, but I was on some advisory panels, people were talking about, well, what we're up against are a bunch of bitter enders, what we're up against a bunch of former regime elements, not understanding that we were in the middle of a sectarian civil war. Similarly, you know, if you look at the way people throw around analogies like Vietnam, or will, I think, throw around analogies to Iraq, there's a real danger that we'll misunderstand our actual circumstances because we're obsessed with an historical memory. So that's one principle. Second one is that planning is important. Of course, everybody wants us to anticipate things, but being able to adapt is more important. And a major theme of the book is how hard it is for governments and for military organizations to actually foresee it in any level of detail the kind of problems they face, and that you just have to adjust to that. You'll prefer to go short, you have to prepare to go long. I think that's one of the great lessons of Iraq. Everybody would prefer a short, sharp war. I think President Trump has that view as well.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily get that. So those are the first three at any rate.
You talk about there being four main challenges that we're looking at going forward, and I would have started off with Russia, so I was kind of surprised. Just give us an overview of what you think those four challenges are.
Right. So the first one is China. China, because it is really the only country that can match us economically, that has a vibrant economy, and that is really attempting to assert its power in a very powerful way in the huge section of the world, in the Asia-Pacific. The second set of challenges is what I call the jihadi threat. So it's Al-Qaeda, but the Islamic State, similar kinds of movements. The third basket is dangerous states. So that's Russia, Iran, North Korea. These are states which do not accept the local international order, are somewhat paranoid, and will do whatever they can to upend that. Now, the reason why I don't put Russia right at the top is because I don't think the Russians have the kind of economic depth that they need to be a really major threat. And then the fourth basket is ungoverned space and the great commons. So in other words, the seas, the outer space, cyberspace, areas which we want to preserve for the use of everybody, but that also requires military power and military dominance.
Now, we've come out of a superpower sort of conflict in the Cold War. This matrix that you've built here, is this more threatening than what we spent the 40, 50 years on, or how do you rate it relatively?
Well, that's hard to do. I'm not one of these people who longs for the days of the Cold War. The Cold War was very dangerous. We could have had a third world war that would have really wiped humanity off the face of the map. It is much more complicated set of challenges. The kinds of forces, but also just the way you think about problems, your strategic concepts, have to be different for each of those four different baskets, your time horizons. So that I think is the biggest challenge. There is the possibility for things, though, to get very, very violent. So North Koreans are about to test an intercontinental ballistic missile that they could probably put a nuclear weapon on that could reach the United States. That's very serious business.
You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Cavlo, the Biz Talk Radio Network, 350 stations around the country. You can go to biztalkradio.com to find the station closest to you, to listen over the Internet, and to access our podcast. We're going to look at lessons learned from two failed wars in the next segment.
Are you ready to leave your corporate job behind and be your own boss? Have you ever dreamed of owning a business? Do you have $50,000 or more sitting around in a 401k? If you answered yes, it's time to invest in yourself by buying or starting a business or franchise. IRS code allows you to use money in a 401k to invest in a business with absolutely no penalties or taxes. At Guidant Financial, we've helped more than 11,000 entrepreneurs invest $3 billion in retirement assets into the small businesses and franchises of their dreams. So if you've got $50,000 or more in a 401k and you're looking for a way to start a business, call Guidant Financial now for free information and to learn more. Operators are standing by for your call. 800-570-6630. 800-570-6630. 800-570-6630. That's 800-570-6630.
Tired of paying outrageous prices for Viagra? Well, we have great news for you. Now you can finally get Viagra at huge discounts. Healthy Man allows you to save up to $500 on Viagra. Why pay U.S. pharmacy prices of $15 per pill or more when you can get Viagra for less than $3 a pill? Call today and get 40 Viagra pills for only $99. This can cost as much as $600 at your local pharmacy. You can't afford not to call us. If you want Viagra at the lowest prices, never pay $15 a pill pharmacy prices again. Get Viagra for less than $3 a pill. Call 1-800-521-9579 today and save up to $500 and get 40 pills for just $99. Healthy Man is fast, easy, and affordable. Operators are waiting at 1-800-521-9579 to take your call right now. Call 1-800-521-9579. That's 1-800-521-9579. Again, 1-800-521-9579.
If you are struggling to pay or haven't been making your student loan payments, listen carefully to this urgent alert. Have you been out of school for 10 or more years and you're still making your student loan payments? Are your student loans past due or even in default? Can't go back to school because of an old student loan problem? Fast Track Student Loans can get your student loans out of default, stop any wage garnishments, stop collection calls, and stop seizure of your tax refund. Give yourself a break. Stop the stress and get your student loan payments down to as little as $25 a month based on what you can afford to pay. One quick 10-minute call could help you solve your student loan problems. So call right now. Not available in all states. Payments may vary based on income.
800-685-0129. 800-685-0129. 800-685-0129. That's 800-685-0129.
Due to an upturn in the economy, Main Street Business Loans has pre-approved the release of millions of dollars in small business funding. Your business may already be pre-approved to receive up to $250,000. We've sent out millions of pre-approval letters. We see the economy growing, and our underwriters believe now is the time to invest in your business so you can grow faster and make more money. And we're prepared to give you up to $250,000 to do it. Your funds can be available in 5 days. There are no application fees, no annual fees, just quick access to up to $250,000. If your business did not receive your approval letter to get up to $250,000, call Main Street Business Loans Approval Desk now.
800-430-7570. 800-430-7570. 800-430-7570. That's 800-430-7570.
Biz Talk Radio.
We're back with Professor Elliot Cohen of Johns Hopkins University's Zeiss. I got a question that always sort of looms in the back of my mind. We're a superpower, and we have fought Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and I rate that as one stalemate, three losses. They're all relative pipsqueaks, really. Why don't we win these kind of wars?
These are very difficult wars to win, but I think part of the issue, too, is how we think of winning. I mean, you know, this, in a way, goes to the part of me that's an American military historian. Our historical imagination is shaped by, I would say, chiefly by the Civil War and by World War II. Mm-hmm. Both big conventional wars fought over a period of roughly 4 years each, decided with an overwhelming victory for one side. That's not what most warfare is like throughout history. And it's actually not what most of our wars have been like. And so I think we need to sort of recalibrate our expectations to some extent.
All right, let me ask it before we dive deeper, the same kind of question, which is, this is also fascinates me as a management perspective. George Bush, 43, reacting on gut, not a lot of due diligence, wasn't even really deeply aware of the Sunni-Shia split. He goes in, and we know what happened there. President Obama comes in, rational, deep thinker, and left the Middle East arguably worse off than W did. So in other words, both approaches seem to fail.
Right. It tells you what a difficult place the Middle East is. Of course, the everybody's natural impulse is to say, well, then who needs the Middle East? But, you know, the problem fundamentally is that the Middle East is not like Las Vegas. It's not the case that what happens in the Middle East stays in the Middle East. And so the Middle East gets interested in us, even if we're not interested in it. Look, I think there are different kinds of mistakes that were made by Bush and by Obama, and I can be critical of the Bush administration, even though I served in it. Some of it, by the way, has to do with our military institutions. Some of it has to do with the way we prepared for the follow-through. Some of it does have to do with intelligence. But, you know, fundamentally, the challenge that every American president from George Bush on had or is going to have is that they will be wartime commanders-in-chief, and that really takes time to sink in. What that means, and what kind of supervision of the military that means, and that's partly the topic of another book of mine, Supreme Command. But I think Bush was not prepared for that in a different way. Obama was not prepared for it, and I suspect that President Trump isn't either, really.
So we're not doomed to repeat the past, maybe.
Well, I think we'll probably make different kinds of mistakes, but we'll make lots of mistakes.
Not understanding our enemies, civil war in Vietnam, and that sort of that's what broke out in Iraq. What's your bottom line points for why we failed in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, the first thing I would say is let me push back a little bit on the idea that we failed in Iraq. For sure, we made a whole bunch of mistakes going. I spent a lot of time in Iraq when I was counselor of the State Department, and in 2008, by the time we were done, not just my feeling, but the feeling of very senior career diplomats like Ryan Crocker or Jim Jeffrey, who were really experienced Middle East hands, who had not been in favor of the Iraq War, by the way, was that place was on a fragile trajectory to success. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, you could walk around Baghdad in the end of 2008 in a way that you could not.
You mean outside of the green zone?
Oh, yeah. And if you look at casualty rates, if you look at the kind of politics that was going on, the fundamental mistake there, I think, was a really precipitous withdrawal, and that we paid a very high price for that. And, you know, as we know, President Obama found himself launching really what's the third Iraq war.
He was able to fight pretty much under the table, right? I mean, I don't think a lot of people.
And that, by the way, I think is something of a problem. I mean, it's I'm a great believer in the idea that the it's the business of Congress to authorize the use of military force, and to do it with its eyes open and explaining to the American people why they're doing what they're doing. And that's been a I think one of our bigger problems is that our political leadership hasn't always really felt that it had to explain why they're doing what they're doing to the American people and to do it repeatedly.
One thing that I was very critical of is I've studied this now from guests and stuff, but counterinsurgency generally takes 9 or 10 years to even have a shot at winning, and neither President Bush or President Obama presented the wars in that terms at all.
I think that's absolutely right. I was actually involved in writing the new counterinsurgency manual.
With Petraeus, you mean?
Yeah. I've known Petraeus and Mattis both, actually, for quite a long time.
Great guys.
They're both extraordinary leaders. And I think they were very realistic about it. But, you know, if you look, and this is why, I do assign fundamental responsibility to civilian leadership. They are the ones accountable. But the fact is that not all of the American military was led by Petraeus's and Mattis's. There were some generals who were perfectly good generals for kind of conventional war in Europe. That's what they've been trained for. They were not suited to these kinds of conflicts. So, for example, General Dave McKiernan was relieved by Secretary Gates during the Obama administration in Afghanistan. It wasn't because he was a bad guy. He's a very good guy. Not the right guy for that war.
Mm-hmm. So you don't believe that if Saddam had stayed in power and kept the Band-Aids, Sunni, Shia, and Kurds together, that would have been better off? And you said we ended in 2008 before President Obama.
I really I don't, because I think, it's a big mistake to think that, if you left it alone, nothing would happen. I think you would have had a crisis no matter what. One thing to remember in 2003, the Iraqis were getting out from under both the nuclear inspections, and from sanctions. And, in fact, people have even written books. There's a Canadian political scientist wrote a book saying, if Al Gore had become president, and even if there were no 9/11, there would have been another Iraq war. And I think that's plausible.
Afghanistan, now that to me, no one's ever been successful there. The Soviets failed. It's a backward country. It's corrupt. There's a lot of terror. But Obama thought that was a just war. Did you think we had a shot there? And what do you think?
I did. I probably spent even more time there than I did in Iraq, and I think people would say that. First, again, you have to be somewhat wary of the some of the folk wisdom about this. Mm-hmm. The truth is, the Afghan people were very glad to see us show up. We could have had a much larger force there earlier. We made a number of unforced errors in terms of going after al-Qaeda. And also in the political system that we helped create. I think the challenge in Afghanistan, as in a different way in Iraq, is never really having kind of an honest conversation with ourselves about, well, what is it that we can reasonably expect to create here or to help shape? There are also, there are other kinds of errors that we make that we need to look at. For example, the way we pour economic aid into these countries. Actually, it usually makes things worse. There are all kinds of distortions that creep in. One of the things that I'm concerned about is we're not going to do this sort of thing for a while, I think, but we may. After Korea, people said, well, we're never going to fight a war in Asia. Well, we fought Vietnam. And after Vietnam, we'll never do this sort of thing again. Well, we did Iraq. There are a lot of lessons of a kind of operational nature, of an organizational nature, which people should pay attention to, because the chances are that we will find ourselves in circumstances sometime in the next 20, 25 years where we'll do something somewhat similar. And it's not enough to just say, boy, we'll never do that again.
Yeah, and you're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell. We'll be back. Segment 3, the big 4 threats to America.
If you're 85 or younger, would you like peace of mind and comfort for your family? We're Final Expense Direct with an urgent message for you. The average funeral today costs over $8,000, but the most you'll get from government benefits is $255. How will your family pay the difference? We can help. Our senior plans start as low as just a dollar a day and pay up to $30,000 for a funeral and other final expenses. Peace of mind is easy. There's no medical exam. You'll have lifetime coverage, and your plan can't be canceled as long as you pay your premiums. Call now for free information about our senior plans. Answer a few simple questions and receive approval right on the phone. Plus, call right now and we'll give you a discount prescription card for free. Call 800-373-0345. That's 800-373-0345. Again, 800-373-0345.
This alert just came in. This special announcement is for business owners and leaders of organizations who've been waiting for the right time to build. General Steel has made it impossible to wait any longer with rock-bottom prices that could save you thousands. That's right, General Steel, America's leader in pre-engineered structures, is offering buildings at prices you will never see again. Don't miss these prices. A 50 by 100 for under $30,000. You heard right. That's 5,000 square feet under $30,000. Manufacturers, if you need a larger building, try a 100 by 100 commercial building for $129,000. You can't afford to rent with these prices. Imagine a 70 by 100 foot church building for under $69,000. With the economy improving and interest rates still at historic lows, you can't afford to wait.
Call 800-605-5370. 800-605-5370. Call 800-605-5370.
All right, guys, we're ready for our four-season sunroom, and Daddy's gonna get a rec room with refreshments.
Oh, no, we'll be sleeping under the stars.
Mom, what about the one with, you know, the fun?
Nice try, little bro. It's a gym. My gym.
Hey, Grandma's getting her Four Seasons garden room. Weather tight and still like being outdoors.
Maybe a living room. Oh, no, wait. A family hub.
Yeah!
No matter what the budget, the season, or the climate, Four Seasons sunrooms let you and your family enjoy the outdoors inside. Call now to hear more about these great offers from the premier manufacturer of sunrooms since 1975.
More reasons for Four Seasons now.
To find out more, call toll-free 800-973-5533. That's 800-973-5533. Call 800-973-5533 today.
Hi, I'm Joan London. If you're worried about your parent or loved one living alone, like I was, and you want reliable senior care information, then call A Place for Mom, the nation's largest senior living referral service.
Finding an apartment that was on the courtyard with the view of the trees, the view of the ducks, the stream, the creek, all of that, that was what I needed.
You'll get free information on assisted living, Alzheimer's care, nursing homes, even important financial information. Here's the number.
To speak to a local senior living advisor, call A Place for Mom at 800-506-0320. That's 800-506-0320.
A Place for Mom is a free service, and you can trust them to help you. So if you're struggling to find reliable senior living information, there's a place for answers, A Place for Mom.
To speak to a local senior living advisor, call A Place for Mom at 800-506-0320. That's 800-506-0320.
How old are you? 25, 35, 50, or older? If you have pain, we can help. Do your knees hurt?
Ow!
Let me ask you again. Are your knees killing you?
Oh, yeah. Are they ever?
What about your back? When you bend over, does it feel like this? How about when you get out of bed in the morning? If you're like me, your knees and back feel like this.
Oh, that hurts.
I found a company called the Pain Relief Hotline. They specialize in ways to treat your knee, back, and neck pain without surgery or taking medications. The good news is if you have insurance, you may have little or no cost or out-of-pocket expense. I've used them. It works. Call the Pain Relief Hotline now for free information. 800-303-4607. 800-303-4607. Call now. 800-303-4607. That's 800-303-4607.
Biz Talk Radio.
We're back with Elliot Cohen, the author of The Big Stick, The Limits of Soft Power and the Necessity of Military Force. We're going to look at the future now, the big four threats. And an interesting stat I wanted to go through was in your book, which is you had a table of the U.S. defense expenses as a percentage of total defense expenses in the world, 1998 versus 2015. The U.S. was about 36% of all defense spending and is now 34%, basically the same share. But here's one that will blow you away. Russia was 32%, almost equivalent with us in 88, and they're now 5%, which now you can start to see why you don't see them in the same league. China, 1%, now 12%. Pretty fascinating stuff, isn't it?
It really is, and I think it's a pretty stark illustration of some of the kind of major shifts that go on without us really noticing. You know, we tend to focus on what's in today's news, but there are frequently these kind of big structural changes which people really need to take on board. And you're right. It's why I, in many ways, worry more about the Chinese than about the Russians.
Okay, and now we'll segue into China. I look at China a little bit like in the 1970s, I was at IBM. We were convinced that Japan was taking over the world, was going to take over IBM. And now there's been that feeling that China is the guys that are going to take over. Talk about them as the number one threat and whether you see that happening.
Well, I think they are a challenge. I mean, I agree with you, and I think, you know, the history that you mentioned is relevant, where, you know, the people became obsessed with Japan as number one, and it turned out that they weren't. Similarly, the Chinese have all kinds of problems that, you know, demography, environmental issues, and so forth, which will limit them. But that said, this is, unlike the Soviet economy, this is a dynamic economy. It is obviously a huge country with a huge GDP, and they have been pouring vast sums of money, rather well spent, into developing very modern forces. They've got the best of Soviet technology, and they're really good at stealing ours.
Yes.
Plus, they've got it from other countries, too. And their fundamental objective, I think, is not to dominate the world. It is to write the rules for Asia and to be the dominant power in Asia. And I think they do want to push us back to the perimeter. I'm not in favor of getting hysterical about that. I don't think we should or we have to. But I do think we got to take it seriously. And I think, by the way, throughout the book, you know, one of the things about it is I'm not really a doom and gloom guy who thinks that we're going to have extraordinary difficulties. I think if we're smart, we can manage all of these, and including China.
Mm-hmm. Withdrawing from the TPP, does that play into the hands of China?
Absolutely. It was dumb. Mm-hmm. I was frankly appalled. I was appalled by President Trump attacking it. I was even more appalled by Hillary Clinton, you know, walking back her support for it, given that she was
That was political.
That it was profoundly political, but in extremely damaging, because for our allies, look, one of America's greatest strategic advantages is our alliance system and the confidence that people have in us. And the sense that, okay, we can be difficult in various ways, but that basically we are steady, we are reliable, and we're on their side. Well, we just pulled the rug out from under a whole bunch of our Asian allies.
Yeah.
And the Chinese are now the ones out there who have a competing organization. And they're saying, look, we're the ones who are in favor of global free trade.
Looking at China now, what are some of the things that could trigger a confrontation, and how do you see us, should we counter and avoid them?
Well, I think, you know, the Chinese have always had this thing they call the nine-dash line, where they basically kind of draw a line with nine dashes, very imprecise, around the South China Sea, and say, this is actually Chinese territory, that China is three parts land and one part water, that one part water being the South China Sea, which is a vast area. If they get to assert something like that successfully, it has tremendous implications for freedom of navigation, for supply lines of allies like the sea lanes for countries like Japan, but once again, for the whole world order. I mean, one of the things the U.S. Navy quietly does is it maintains freedom of navigation around the world. That's an incredibly important role. So how could we come to blows? Well, they've, as you know, they've been building a bunch of artificial islands, which are military bases in the South China Sea. They've been trying to, in effect, assert sovereignty over that. And you could have our forces bumping into each other, and they could bump into each other by accident, but one thing can lead to another. Another way in which you could see conflict would be between China and Japan.
What about Taiwan?
And also very much with Taiwan. And again, it, particularly if they, the Chinese are very sensitive about Taiwan. They also really want to bring it into, you know, make it formally a part of the People's Republic. So those are three big ways which could happen.
So was President Trump playing with a little fire there, or it's a good negotiating chip?
He was playing a little bit with fire. The truth is, you know, in and of itself, taking a phone call from the president of Taiwan doesn't bother me.
Right.
But what does bother me is that he clearly did it without having a kind of a well-staffed process where you think through, you know, if we do this, they might do that. What will we do if they do that, and so forth? I mean, that's one of the things that's scariest about this administration is that they just don't seem to believe in orderly thinking through of policies. It's whatever erupts from the president's mouth, and that is very, very dangerous. Even if the policy that you're, you know, trying to articulate is not in itself completely crazy.
All right, let's go to the jihadis now. And you make, I think, an incredibly important point here, but we're talking Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, all these Islamic extremists. But you look at this as a decades-long project, and I think Trump has partially sold that these guys are going to be wiped out by Mattis in a couple of weeks.
Right, and he's wrong about that. And I doubt that General Mattis, or Secretary Mattis, as he now is, would think that either. In the book, I quote General Peter Lay, who's the former chief of the Australian Army, who said, this is a 100 years war. Now, that on the one hand, that's a very chilling thought.
Yeah, it is.
On the other hand, if you think about it that way, you can say, okay, so this is really for the long haul. We have to think strategically in a different way than we're used to thinking. I mean, I taught at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. The wars we taught lasted between 6 days and 6 years. This is a different kind of war. But it doesn't pose an immediate existential threat to us, so we can be patient. Whereas I think if you go in and you think you're going to wipe all these guys out with a lot of blood and thunder, first you won't. These organizations and movements are very good at kind of changing shape and changing even their bases and how they operate and so forth, and you'll get that. And the Trump approach, I think, also would be dangerous because we'd go in, we would smash a lot of stuff, alienate a lot of people, and leave. And we'd be very surprised when, you know, in a year or two after that, the threat just manifests itself in a different way.
All right, I want to move on to dangerous states, and you also make a lot of great insights as we go through some of these. In Russia, you really basically say that due to the economic decline, their demographics, they are in a long-term decline regardless. So Putin playing a weak hand, right?
He's playing a weak hand, but you have to say that he's playing it absolutely
brilliantly.
Absolutely brilliantly. You know, you look at the way in which, you know, the local powers in the Middle East go to Moscow, not to Washington. They've reestablished themselves there. They've dismantled, in effect, Ukraine, a state that they guaranteed. They've got the Europeans intimidated. And
Article 5 of NATO under threat?
I think so. I think we could find it being invoked by, say, one of the Baltic states. And let's not forget, they really did attempt to interfere in our
election.
And that is a non-trivial event. And I have to say, I found it shocking that people haven't gotten more excited by it. That's a very big deal.
Syria now, which actually you can link right to who we're just talking about, since Russia's put themselves there. Did we make a fundamental mistake on the red line, and what's your take on Syria?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think anybody who's served in government knows, and actually any reasonable historian knows, credibility really matters. If you say it's a red line, it better be a red line. It may sound strange, but actually, you know, one of the problems we may have with Trump will be that we'll have a version of the Obama red line with him. You know, let's not forget, he settled that suit against Trump University for $25 million. He's a bully, and so like most bullies, he backs down when confronted by somebody who's tougher than he is. So we could have another red line. The other thing about Syria is that it really illustrates that deciding not to act is still a really big decision.
Yeah.
The upshot of Syria is 500,000 dead, 12 million refugees, massive instability in the Middle East, massive refugee movements, destabilizing European governments.
A man who uses chemical weapons running it.
Chemical weapons. I mean, this is the difficulty of being an American decision maker. Action doesn't look good, but, you know, inaction can have some pretty terrible consequences, too.
Profound stuff. You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell from our flagship stations, Yale Radio, WYBC, and WGCH Greenwich. Final segment, The Need for the Big Stick.
Have you heard about BizTV? BizTV is the home for America's entrepreneurs, small businesses, and those who want to succeed in life. It's the first national television network committed to airing original, high-quality, educational, and inspirational programming about real business people. Small businesses drive America forward, generating 64% of all new jobs in the last decade. With over 30 million small businesses in the U.S., shouldn't you be watching BizTV? With the right kind of ideas, motivation, and education to help fuel the next generation of business owners, BizTV is the network you should be watching. Success stories, new ideas turned into businesses, programs full of sales tips, goal setting, how to manage, how to raise capital, and improving work-life balance. BizTV is for those who want to succeed. Visit BizTV.com and call your satellite or cable service provider to request BizTV.
National Funding Group has just released $100 million in easy access small business funding to businesses that gross at least $100,000 a year. You can have fast access up to $500,000 in new business capital in as little as 48 hours. Think about the ways you could grow your business if you had up to $500,000 cash infusion. Call a NFG funding expert now. The process is easy. It only takes about 5 minutes. Then our management-owned lending team looks at your application for a fast approval. You can get 100% funded in about 2 days. If you need up to $500,000 in working capital to run your business and you gross at least $100,000 a year, call NFG and apply today. 800-296-1564. 800-296-1564. 800-296-1564. That's 800-296-1564.
If your credit card bills have gotten out of hand, call Consolidated Credit now. If you're making the minimum payments, but your balance is just not going down, call Consolidated Credit now. If the interest rates on your credit cards are so high, it will take years to get out of debt, call Consolidated Credit now. They've helped over 5 million people with credit card debt. They can consolidate your debts into one lower payment, reduce your interest rates, and get you out of debt fast. If you're struggling with credit card debt, the first step is yours. Call Consolidated Credit now. Call 800-463-1749. 800-463-1749. That's 800-463-1749. Consolidated Credit Counseling Services Incorporated, 5701 West Sunrise Boulevard, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, 33313. Not a loan company. Licensed by the New York Department of Financial Services or by the Vermont Department of Financial Regulation. Maryland DM-19, Oregon DM-80031. Licensed by the Virginia State Corporation Commission. License number DC-32.
I live alone and rarely have visitors. So when I slipped and fell in the kitchen last month and couldn't get to a phone, I knew I was in trouble.
Help!
I could barely move.
Help!
I tried calling for help, but no one could hear me. As I lay there, I couldn't help but think of my kids and grandkids having to go on without me. I was terrified. It took 8 hours for my neighbor to find me. It could have been the end of me. That's when I knew I needed Life Alert. With just one press of this button, I'm connected to the Life Alert Center, where I can get the help I need, even when I cannot reach a phone. With Life Alert, I'm never alone.
For a free Life Alert brochure, call 800-635-4993. That's 800-635-4993. Call now at 800-635-4993 to get a free brochure. 800-635-4993.
Here's George Foreman with InventHelp.
Hi, I'm George Foreman. Do you have an idea for a new product or invention? People ask me all the time, George, how do I get my idea in front of companies? How do I get a patent? What do I do next? Do you have the same questions? I'll tell you like I'll tell them all. Call my friends at InventHelp.
Call InventHelp today for free information. InventHelp has been helping inventors for more than 30 years and has sales offices nationwide. InventHelp can submit your invention to companies who are interested in receiving new ideas. If you have an idea and want to try to patent it and submit it to companies, you should call InventHelp today for free information.
Listen, I can't guarantee a company will be interested in your idea, but I believe every inventor deserves the opportunity to step into the ring and take their best shot. Put InventHelp in your corner.
To get your free inventor's information, call 1-800-351-1453. That's 1-800-351-1453. Again, 1-800-351-1453.
Biz Talk Radio.
We're back for our final segment with former State Department Counselor Dr. Elliot Cohen. And let's finish up the threats with number four, cyberspace, outer space, what you call the common spaces.
If you go back to the 19th century, the Royal Navy maintained freedom of navigation for everybody. It was a tremendous task, but it helped ensure this tremendous explosion of economic growth around the world in the 19th century. Well, the United States took over that burden in the 20th century, and it's extended beyond. I mean, we're dependent on outer space, for example, for all kinds of things, including just the way our iPhones or Androids work. But we take for granted the idea that these belong to everybody and that nobody can really claim to dominate outer space, for example, or that, we are accustomed to the idea that people have pretty free use of cyberspace. Shouldn't be taken for granted. And there are different forms of military power that are needed to ensure that that's going to remain the case.
We always talk about we're fighting the last war. Are we prepared for cyber warfare?
Well, it's hard to say because, you're talking about a realm that is obviously very dark and, there is actually a lot of secret stuff. So here's, I guess, the things I would say. First, we are, because we're a sort of big, open, sprawling democracy, and people get sloppy, we are vulnerable. All of our organizations are vulnerable. It is made worse by the fact that you don't have to be a big sophisticated country to be really good at this stuff. I mean, even the North Koreans can conduct cyber attacks. So that's point one. Point two, I would say nobody should think that we are behind anybody in our ability to conduct offensive cyber warfare. So I think we have a lot of capabilities that are there, which are hidden, and which, in many cases, people will never learn about. And the third thing is that we do have an advantage, and this kind of speaks to the business world, in that, when it comes to, say, ballistic missile defenses, well, only the military can provide that, right? But when it comes to cyber defenses, huge corporations actually are part of our defensive system, if you think about it, and not just huge defensive systems. I mean, you and I are, if we've got antivirus programs on our machines, we use two-factor authentication and all that sort of stuff. So it's a little bit more complicated, I think, than people sometimes think.
Failed states, and you can throw Libya in there, maybe Somalia, maybe Syria. What do we do with failed states there, which are actually increasing, the Middle East itself?
Yeah, well, this is part of the price that we're paying for what was a strategy of retrenchment. The Libya case is actually a particularly strong case where the European powers actually took the lead on that one, and nobody wanted to be involved in helping to keep that place back together, put that place back together again after the overthrow of Gaddafi. I do think we're going to have to find ways of exercising long-term influence in some of these cases without sending vast expeditionary forces. It's not quite the same thing, but if you look at our commitment in Colombia, for example, which has a real government, but which fought this incredible, vicious 50-year civil war, the United States was able to do an awful lot of good supporting the Colombian government. And it was done across multiple administrations. It was done over a period of decades. And I think, by and large, it was successful. I mean, Americans can be creative at this kind of thing, but they have to understand that they've got to be. And the problem is there are very few places in the world that you can simply abandon, because sooner or later it will somehow affect you, if only because those are the places that the terrorists like to hang out.
I want to ask you now about the enemy within, and I'm talking about our military-industrial complex. You call it pathologies of bureaucracy. I happen to see in C-SPAN, and it's just like theater of the absurd. There's a new combat ship, I may mispronounce this, a littoral combat ship.
Yeah, the littoral combat ship.
And it was talking about, it wasn't even meeting the Navy specs. A Navy admiral there was almost unable to defend it. They could not tell the senators who was actually the designer of the specs. The GAO was there saying every defense acquisition is twice the cost and covers and is twice as late as the. Do we need to break this kind of thing up?
We definitely need to get a lot better at acquisition than we've been. As with most wounds, they're self-inflicted. Basically, a lot of what you have now with all the layers of bureaucracy and so forth, when you dig down into where does it all come from, it usually comes as a reaction to some sort of scandal. We're going to have all kinds of statements that you have to have and all kinds of audits and all kinds of guarantees that everything is going to work absolutely as promised and so forth. And so the result is you have a very risk-averse bureaucracy, actually, which is all over itself trying to avoid making mistakes. And, needless to say, you get more mistakes. I do think part of the future is going to be understanding that we're going to have to tap commercial technology a lot more. Probably should be thinking a little bit more creatively about some of the kinds of weapon systems that we want. We should be more willing to buy stuff off the shelf. I'd be lying to you if I said that I thought I had some easy solutions to dealing with this, because I don't.
Okay, let's finish up now the need for this big stick. Do we need a bigger military? When should we be rolling this stuff out? We did kind of a halvesies in Syria, which didn't seem to work. You mentioned preemptive. You even mentioned low-yield nukes that we should consider, which sounded scary. Talk about the big stick that you see it going forward.
Well, I do think we need a defense buildup. There is a national defense panel, which was bipartisan at the end of the Obama administration, which recommended for a substantially larger budget. But we're still talking something on the order of about 4% of gross domestic product as opposed to the 3% trajectory. Clearly, we got to get rid of the sequester. I mean, that's done a lot of damage. But I think we do have to face the reality at the same time. We're not going to be able to prepare for all of these challenges and deal with them equally well.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the challenge that we have to do is we have to return to an old concept, which is mobilization. That is to say, we think very hard, in normal times, or what kind of forces do we need to be able to generate very, very quickly? And you can't anticipate everything, but that's a kind of strategic approach which was constant throughout our history that we really in many ways have walked away from.
Do you think we should ever, the low-yield nukes, is that something that we should be using as a bargaining chip? Or
Not as a bargaining chip. I think it's something that you want to have. And, when you say that, everybody thinks you're a warmonger. I'm not.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
But the fact of the matter is, if someday a president is looking seriously at the possibility that a North Korean nuclear weapon is going to take out Tokyo or Los Angeles, then all of a sudden, the first use of nuclear weapons becomes not only conceivable, but in many ways an imperative.
Well, you call it like you see it. It's really a fascinating, fascinating book. The book is The Big Stick, The Limits of Soft Power and the Necessity of Military Force, and it's chock full of ideas, insights, recommendations. Our next show, we turn to domestic reform. Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, will look at the need for fundamental budget reform. This has been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Thanks to Dr. Elliot Cohen. Thanks to our national audience for listening, and we'll see everybody again next week on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.
The opinions you hear on Biz Talk Radio are those of the hosts, callers, and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, Biz Talk Radio, its management, or advertisers. The information on Biz Talk Radio does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. Please consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions about Biz Talk Radio, contact us at 817-274-1609 or at biztalkradio.com. Biz Talk Radio.